I'd like to introduce a lady who spoke here in March. I don't know why we had it in March, but I got a good idea. March 6, 1964. And she's been sober since then and before then. Now, her chronological age is she's 39 and holding. And Cora Louise has been around the program a long time. I've had the privilege of knowing her for a number of years. I was stark raving sober when I first met her. And then I got to know her a little bit later, quite a bit later on in service work. And I've often said, you know, the women that come in this program, I admire. And this is another lady I admire because she's worked with a lot of women and a lot of men in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's one of these people that walk like she talks. That's what it's all about. So I want all of you to join me in giving Cora Louise again another good Blackstone welcome. Cora Louise.
Hi, everybody. I'm Cora Louise Belford, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I really want you to know how honored I feel to have been invited back to Blackstone. I was honored the first time, and I'm twice honored this time. And I'm so happy to be participating in this 75th occasion of the Blackstone Retreats. You know, when I stand in the speaker's box and look out at rooms like this, I ask myself the question, how did I get here? I've reached a time in life when I have to call everybody honey or darling or sweetheart because I can't remember their names. And I spend a whole lot of time looking for things that I've put away very carefully, but I seem to have hidden them from myself. My girls tell me that they're going to let me hide my own Easter eggs. But I haven't lived so long that I can't remember, or I hope that I will ever forget how I got here. I know how I got here. I got here through the grace of God, bringing me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me my life. I'm here to tell you my story, how it was, what happened, and how it is now. It really never has been easy for me to do this, but I welcome the opportunity. Because it is the story of the transforming experience of my life. During the years that I drank, I became the kind of woman that I never wanted to be. Destructive, irrational, unpredictable. Thanks to AA, I have been able to at least participate in the process of trying to become a different kind of person. I've never been the kind of person, or at least I never was the kind of person who had much confidence in her own ability to accomplish anything. Appearances were deceiving in this line. But since I've been here, I've found out that it doesn't really matter whether I have confidence in myself or not. If I have confidence in this program, and confidence in the power greater than myself. Why do I need to have confidence in me? I'm all right, and it's a great relief not to have to worry about whether I have confidence in myself or not. When I went to my first meeting, September 1957, at the Lenox Hill Group in New York City, believe me, I never would have thought the time would come when I would be up here talking to you. I didn't even know things like this existed. All I knew was that I wanted to find a way to stop drinking and I was told that this was the place to come. And I had had every other kind of help that is available in a city like New York. And the people that tried to help me were good people. They knew what they were talking about. They probably gave me good advice. But they just didn't give me the right advice. And so by the grace of God, literally, I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had thought I was unique, that nobody's problems were like mine. And I suffered a great deal about it. I may be as unique as my thumbprints, we all are. But as regards my alcoholism, I have everything in common with all of you. We are blood brothers and sisters. I know this and I'm grateful for it. Because of my many years' experience in psychotherapy, 9 years, when I heard you had to take an inventory, I thought, oh, would that be easy? I know all about that. I certainly know all about how to have insight and all that kind of thing. But you were talking about a different kind of inventory and a different kind of insight from what I'd been doing in psychotherapy when I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what other people did to me. Here I had to try to figure out what I did. And this is not always a pleasant confrontation when you have to accept responsibility for yourself and set about trying to make amends and trying to change your ways of thinking and living. This isn't easy. I learned everything from it, from good teachers like you. I learned that I don't control anything or anybody, not even myself, by my efforts alone. I still try to do this from time to time. And I have to be reminded of this. I have to remind myself of it. That's the kind of reminding that means something. It's when I can remind myself that I'm not in control of anything. I found out I could be wrong, that it was all right to be wrong. That it was all right to make mistakes in judgment and to make poor choices. I believe that the only thing that would be really serious or fatal would be if I should cease to be fully committed to this program and the principles of it and to the power greater than myself that I call God, who has seen me through so much this far along the way. I began to drink with anything that you could call regularity, sort of late in life for an alcoholic. I was 26 years old, married, and the mother of two little girls, 6 and 3, before drinking was anything but a very occasional experience in my life. When my husband went overseas with the Marine Corps in World War II, I took this big. I took everything big. And I suffered a great deal. I had heavy anxiety. And I acted like nobody else was in this same situation. And I went to sit out the war in Sewanee, Tennessee, where my mother had a house. And there I discovered that there were a number of other war widows, as we called ourselves, who were there with their children. And we used to get together in the afternoon. And we would turn the kids loose in the yard and let them play in the swings in the sandbox. And we'd sit on the porch and rock and share our experience, strength, and hope with each other over a few drinks. And this was Mecca. I thought this was wonderful, civilized. Where had this wonderful custom been all my life? And I became a clock watcher because all this anxiety began to dissolve when I had that first drink. And so I looked forward to that time of day. Now, I know now, but of course I did not know then, that drinking meant something to me then that it didn't mean to these other women that I was drinking with. Even if I had known it, I don't think it would have made any difference. As long as I was able to drink fairly large amounts and drink successfully, I don't think it would have bothered me. I had an enormous capacity, as it turns out, what we call a hollow leg. I needed it. I was very proud of this. I wore it like an emblem. You know, I could always drive the car home when other people had had too much to drink. I never got tight, and I thought this was wonderful. A new talent that I had discovered. When my husband came home from overseas, I had unrealistic expectations. I always had unrealistic expectations. I thought, now everything's fine. The fairy godmother's about to wave her wand over us, and we will live happily ever after. And it didn't work out quite like that. My husband had been overseas with the Marines. I had been in Suwanee, Tennessee, with two children and friends. We'd had different kinds of experiences, and it wasn't like it had been. When he had been home, he noticed when he came home that I had become a daily drinker. He didn't criticize it. He just noticed it. And pretty soon he became a daily drinker, too, as far as that goes. When he'd been home for a few months, we moved to New York with the idea of staying there for 1 year while he got an advanced degree. We ended up staying there 35 years. And it was a wonderful life. Absolutely a wonderful life. I wouldn't take anything for having been there. I would feel deprived almost if I hadn't had the experiences that I had when I was there. If I hadn't been there, I never would have had the opportunity to work in the General Service Office. I didn't have any special talents for it. I just was there, and I was available, and I wanted the job, and this was wonderful. But when we first moved to New York, I thought the change, the geographical change, would do everything for me, and that Lee and I would be as we always had been, and that we would have a wonderful time. But this anxiety that I had grew by leaps and bounds, because things just weren't working out. And when we'd been there for about a year, we went to see a man at St. Luke's Hospital who recommended what kind of treatment people had needed for nervous problems like I had. And they put me through a battery of tests. And then I came back for an interview with this man again, and he suggested that I should go into psychoanalysis. Now, this was 1946. Not everybody I knew was having psychoanalysis at this time. Now they are, but not then. The only people I knew who were having psychoanalysis were crazy. And I certainly didn't think I was crazy. And I was incensed by this. We had problems, but I was the one that had to go to the shrink. I did resent it a whole lot. But I really did want to save the marriage. I really did want to be a good mother to my children. And so I reluctantly agreed. And after a year and a half of going to the therapist 3 and 4 times a week, even in the summertime, I went to a party. And I drank in the usual manner and in the usual amounts. I still think this is true. Only this night, a very peculiar thing happened. I got drunk, and I had a blackout. And I didn't really approve of people getting drunk. I approved of people drinking the way I drank, which was successfully. I didn't approve of getting drunk. This was a terrible shock. I had never even heard of a blackout at this time. I'd fallen down a flight of stairs and landed on my head on a stone terrace, and I thought I had a concussion, and that's why I didn't remember anything. I was too ashamed to go to a regular doctor. But I did discuss it with the therapist, and he said all the things I wanted to hear. He said, oh, this is the kind of thing that could happen to anyone once. You know, it might even be a good sign. It might even mean that this armor that you've carried so successfully is beginning to crack. He said, however, until we solve certain difficult problems that we're dealing with, it might be a good idea if you were extra careful about your drinking. And I agreed wholeheartedly. I certainly intended to be careful. And I tried to be careful. I tried every way that I could think of and every way that anybody could suggest to me to be careful. The trouble was, though I didn't know it, the therapist didn't know it, my family didn't know it, my friends didn't know it, I had already lost the ability to be careful. I had already crossed whatever that invisible line is that separates those people who can drink from those who can't. I had already reached the point of no return as far as drinking was concerned. Drinking had already become the imperative factor in my life. I don't mean by that I was drunk every day. I wasn't. I don't mean by that I wasn't really sick from drinking. I was sick, but I wasn't sick from drinking. I was sick from thinking. That's right. That's what happened to me. What made it imperative was that it controlled practically everything I did. I mean, where to drink, what to drink, when to drink, with whom to drink, how to drink. These became the questions that were constantly going through my mind. At this time, it would have been impossible for me to believe that I had been licked by a thing like booze. And I honestly did believe, and in this I had the support of my family, most people who knew me well, and the therapist, that if I could only continue in this treatment and get rid of this heavy anxiety, that I would be able to find what they all referred to as the real me. Oh, boy. I found it all right, but it wasn't what I was looking for. I continued to look for my answers, not only in psychotherapy. I just thought that surely that I could find an answer there, and that then I would be able to drink again normally, and that I could put some order in my life. But I put myself on a treadmill of activity. I was like something out of Alice in Wonderland, running as fast as I could to stay where I was. But I was slipping all the time, and I knew I was slipping all the time, and I didn't know what to do about it besides what I was already doing about it. But more and more, I began to sense this terrible emptiness and feeling like I was feeling inside as though I were like a leaf on the ground ready to break. But the only way I knew how to fill this emptiness and to quiet these fears was with the contents of a bottle. And here I really did always find an answer, as I said, but it wasn't the one that I was looking for. I endowed this fantastic search for the will-o'-the-wisp, known as the real me, with every ounce of energy and imagination and resource that I possessed. I continued to look for it in psychotherapy. It is not remarkable that the therapist was not able to help me with drinking. I discussed it with him that one time, and never again. I went to the kind of therapy where you presented. They didn't say anything to you. You had to bring the problem. Well, I wasn't bringing this one. But as time went on and things didn't get better, I really did think, well, maybe I ought to talk to him about it, really. So I would plan to do it, and I wouldn't. Finally, I even began to write notes about what I was going to say to him. And on the way to his office, I would get into such panic, I would tear up the notes and have to try to make up something to account for the kind of condition I was in. I didn't show up drunk ever, but I showed up so hungover, I was practically cross-eyed. And I mean, he had been to school, so he must have known what was wrong. But I never discussed the problem. So it's no wonder he couldn't help me with it. I sought for my answers in worthy causes, thinking that if I could find something bigger than me that I could throw myself into, I was big on drama, as you can see. Something big that I could throw myself into. Then I would be able to give myself to that and I wouldn't drink so much. But I never did find anything that big. I sought for answers in books and study. I was living up by Columbia University and my husband was working down at New York University and I was always taking a course, thinking that I would learn how other people gained wisdom and I would be able to apply this to myself. But I didn't find anything that seemed to apply to me. I sought for my answers in domesticity and home life. And my house has never been so clean. Nobody was going to say she's let things go because she drinks too much. I used to run into the shower and wash my hair at 3 o'clock in the morning so nobody could say I was letting myself go. I gave more parties than I've ever given. Frequently, I wouldn't remember that I had invited people to the party and they would show up. I got on the telephone when I drank and I didn't usually have any recollection of it. I sought for my answers in my religion, which I had turned my back on several years before. But I didn't seem to get it right. I was busy telling the higher power what my will for me was, which was that I should be able to drink like I used to. I had to come here to find that it works the other way around. And I sought for my answers at Ebbets Field in the days when the Dodgers were still in Brooklyn. I was a wild, fanatic Dodger fan. And I thought if I had to get out to the ballpark 177 times every summer and get home, that maybe I wouldn't drink so much. So I got my family to go together and give me a season ticket to all the Dodger home games. And 177 times every summer I got on the subway and I went to Brooklyn. And by the grace of God, I got home from Brooklyn. Because at Ebbets Field, I discovered beer. And the beer vendors discovered me. And when they were coming by for the seventh inning stretch, they would automatically put down 4 cans of beer beside my chair and say, "Lady, I hope it doesn't go into extra innings because we're not coming back." At the same time, I was looking in all these places for answers. I was, of course, looking for my answers in the contents of a bottle. And here I found the answers, as I've said before, but they were not the ones that I was looking for. Because it was out of this bottle that became a Pandora's box. And out of this Pandora's box came this woman who was so destructive and irrational and unpredictable that she scared everyone, including herself. I thought that this creature who came out of the bottle was the real me. Everything else was fraud. What came out of the bottle was it. That's what I was. The chaos and confusion that were created in my life and in the life of all those people who were close to me by this attempt of mine to live 2 lives at the same time. One, trying at least to be somehow constructive. And the other, on the dark side of the moon, as I used to say, where all this destruction came from. The chaos and confusion that were created by all of this has brought me to the point of despair where nothing seemed worth the effort anymore. The gap was too wide. The gap between this person who made some sort of attempts at worthwhile living and this creature who was so beset by obsessive and compulsive drinking that she poisoned or cooked or kicked over every good thing she did. This gap just seemed to me too wide to cross. And I didn't think that I would ever be able to find a bridge that would span it. And it was in this kind of defeated and burnt out frame of mind, when I thought my life was over, any part that could matter. I was 38 years old and I thought it was over. It was in this frame of mind that I showed up at my first AA meeting. And I hadn't been going to AA meetings very long before I found that key that I was looking for to this door, this magic door that I was always looking for. And I found the key that opened the first door when I was able to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic, accept the fact that there was nothing that I could do to change that, that I could change the meaning of it and take the destruction out of it by becoming a sober alcoholic one day at a time. It was a simple program they laid out before me. I was so terrified when I came there. I really don't know what I thought would happen. I was not prepared for what really did happen. But AA became for me a kind of school. And to this day, it still is. And I learned the things, the little home truths, that I still don't hear any place else except in AA. I learned to stay away from the first drink. I knew it was the first drink that got me into trouble. I didn't know how to stay away from it. They gave me tools. They told me about the 24-hour plan, about what they used to call nickel therapy. We had to call it 50-cent therapy today. That's the telephone call. Candy bars. I hadn't eaten a candy bar since I was 10 years old. I started buying them by the case. And, you know, I wasn't even sure I was an alcoholic at this point, because I hadn't done all the terrible things that I heard people say you had to do to be an alcoholic. But I learned right at that first meeting that I was just lucky. That if I continued to drink, all those things not only could happen to me, but surely would happen to me. I was just lucky that I had been found in time. Before I talk any more about AA and my experience in AA, I want to tell you about the last time I drank. I never want to forget this. They say if you can't forget your last drunk, you might not have had it. And I hope I've had mine. It was Labor Day weekend, and I was expecting company for the weekend. And I had laid in heavy supplies. And it was drinking company that was coming, and this was going to be great. I was going to have a ball. And at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was in my kitchen getting ready for the company who was coming the next day. And I was tired, and I took the first drink. I knew about postponing the first drink. I'd been postponing it for years. I mean, I tried to postpone it till 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, and then I thought I was on my own time and I could do it, because I could get through what I had to do before I would be drunk. I took the first drink, and when I took it, I was just overwhelmed with this sort of sickening sense of recognition of the hopelessness and the helplessness of my situation. I really hated what alcohol did to me. And I had hated it for years. And I had tried all these ways to stop drinking, but to handle it. And I hadn't been able to. And suddenly I realized something had to be done. But I didn't have another thought about what had to be done. I just walked to the telephone, and I called my husband. And for the first time in my life, I said something appropriate about my drinking. I said, please try not to be angry with me. When you get home, I'll probably be drunk. But I hope it will be the last time. And out of the blue, from nowhere, came these words that subsequently saved my life. I said, if you'll call AA, I'm willing to give it a try. I've tried everything else. I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic or not. If I am, I know it isn't my fault, but it will be if I don't try to find out and do something about it. We know it's helped lots of people with the drinking problem. And it doesn't cost anything. So what have I got to lose? Because he was speechless. Absolutely speechless for me to be saying such a thing to him on the telephone. He said, I said, call up. Find out where their meetings are, and I'll go. So we hung up the phone. And I felt great. I felt like I was in the dead center of the universe. I had made the big decision. And I had told him that I would probably be drunk by the time he got home. So I owed it to myself this one last time. And so I took a few drinks. And routinely with me, after the fourth drink, I got on the telephone. Oh, I used to put notes on the telephone saying, do not use this phone. And I would dash downstairs the day that the bill was going to come for the telephone bill and grab it. It's out of control. And I want you to let me call Dr. Ruth Fox. And I want you to go to see her. And I said, thank you very much. I have been to a few counselors and psychotherapists and whatnot. And no more money is going to be spent on me and my problems. I'll have to find another way. So I got rid of him as fast as I could. So I could tear into my husband. Because I was sure he had Milton up to this. He had told him to say this to me. You know, Milton was a doctor. He'd been through school and medical school, and he'd lived a while. He knew something. I don't know why I thought Lee had to rat on me, but I was sure he had. So I tore into him. And then we spent what was probably the worst week we've ever spent in our lives. He told me later that things just were so out of hand that he started to call Milton, get Milton, put me in the hospital. I wasn't sick, but he knew I was dangerous to him, and he thought I might be dangerous to myself, too. However, he didn't call. And after I'd had that conversation with him, almost as soon as I hung up the phone, it rang. And it was the same doctor. He said, I want to know if you've been thinking about the conversation we had last week. I said, what? I said, this is uncanny that you should call me right now. And I had to sit down and I said, let me tell you what just happened. And I told him what I had said to Lee. That I wanted to go to Ogden tomorrow, that I would go to AA if he'd find out. Milton said, you said you'd be willing to go to AA? I wouldn't have dared suggest it. Why won't they suggest it? I just, you know, it just really bugs me if they won't suggest it. They suggest everything else that costs a lot. But they don't suggest going to AA. And I said, well, you don't think this is what I ought to do? He said, it's the very best thing you possibly could do. I said, do you think that it would be infantile of me? Infantile. I didn't act infantile much, you know. You think it would be infantile of me if I asked Lee to go with me? I'm scared. He said, listen, if Lee doesn't want to go with you, call me. I'll go. Just go. So then it's when I got on the telephone. And I called up everybody I knew. And I told them this big news. Not one soul said, you don't need that. All of them said how fine that was. And the next morning when I came to, as from under an anesthetic, my phone started ringing. Now, I was having second thoughts by this time about this big decision I'd made. But the phone started ringing. And everybody was reminding me about my telephone call because they knew I sometimes forgot that I had spoken with them. They reminded me and I said, gee, thanks a lot. Here I was stuck with it. I had to go. Well, that weekend, my company came that night. I wasn't the night my husband got home, there wasn't any meeting to go to. I was drunk, like you said. Like I told him I would be. And then Saturday and Sunday and Monday, I had company. So so I couldn't go. But I knew enough about AA to know that you didn't teach people to drink, that the idea was you stop drinking. And so I didn't drink. I sat there looking noble and tragic and heroic, drinking water while they swilled up my whiskey. The morning after this party, after this, my sister was getting ready to leave. This was a Tuesday after Labor Day. And as I was saying goodbye to her, she said, "Now listen, you have got to find a better way, because none of us can stand you like this, sitting there like a stone model Madonna. And that's not what you are," she said. I said, "Oh, well, I'm going to try." So I spent the rest of the day throwing up. I was so scared and sick in my stomach. And that night, we walked out of the house to go to the beginners meeting at the old Manhattan group. I said, as I stepped out onto the porch, "Lord knows I have really done it now. I'm about to be pitched, about to take a leap into the darkness." Little did I know that leap would turn out to be my leap of faith. And the darkness would turn out to be better than any light that I had ever known. But I didn't know this then. I was humiliated. I thought that I was permanently broken in spirit. It turned out that what was broken was my will. It had to be broken because it didn't know how to bend. I wasn't sure I was an alcoholic because I hadn't lost all the things I thought alcoholics had to lose. I still had my husband. I still had my children. I still had my house. I still had the price of the next bottle. So how could I be an alcoholic? I just didn't know any of these things. We went to that meeting and we got out of the taxi cab, and the Manhattan group was in a section of New York that had not yet experienced urban renewal. It was what you might call run down. And I got out of the cab and I said, "God, what would my grandmother think if she could see me now?" I didn't worry about what she thought about what got me there. Anyway, I said to Lee, "If I ever needed a drink in my life, I need it now." He said, "Let's just go to the meeting. When the meeting is over, if you have to have a drink, we'll go get a drink." So I walked in, and I was shaking, and I thought I might have to sign something. And I couldn't sign anything. So we went to the beginner's meeting, and I sat there with my head ducked like that. And this absolutely wonderful man who, with his wife, became our close friends. He was from Knoxville, Tennessee. He looked like my father, and he sounded like my brother. And he began to say these wonderful things that nobody else says but a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this great and profound piece of wisdom which he gave me, which woke me up after all those years at NYU and New School and Columbia and all that studying, he finally said these words that turned the screws. He said, "You can't be a little bit alcoholic," which I thought I was, "any more than you can be a little bit pregnant. It's just a question of how far the disease has progressed." And I thought, yeah, that's it. See, my brother was an alcoholic. My father had been an alcoholic. I knew how they behaved. I wasn't like that. When they drank, they drank. They didn't do anything else but drink. They went on binges. I didn't go on binges. I did other things besides drinking. I didn't think I could be an alcoholic. But I knew from what he said what he meant. And I began to listen. And I began to learn a little bit. And we went downstairs from that beginner's meeting to the open meeting at that group. And the leader's wife was sitting beside me, a perfectly charming, beautiful woman who became my dearest friend. Lee was sitting on one side and Abilene was sitting on the other, and we went to the regular meeting. And in New York, the custom was to have three speakers and a leader. And all three speakers this night were men, which was unusual. And all three of them had come from a Bowery background, Skid Row. Well, poor dear Adeline, the leader's wife, was sitting next to me, fanning. She said, well, I hope you're good. Another meeting tomorrow night. But most of them aren't like this. Most of them aren't this tough. But Lee said, and I smiled. Lee said, maybe I shouldn't have brought you here. You never did anything like this. Do you want to leave? I said, please shut up and let me hear what they're saying. And his teeth nearly fell out. He was shocked. Not because I had been rude to him. That was regular. He knew how to handle that. He was shocked that I was listening to what they wanted to say and what they had to say, and I didn't want him to interrupt. He pretty soon realized that what was sitting next to him now was not the same thing that had come into this meeting with him. I didn't know that. But I do know that I listened. And I was able to suspend criticism and analysis and judgment and instead to listen and consequently to learn a little bit. And I went to a meeting the next night after that and the next and the next. My husband was between semesters at NYU where he was a professor. And most of his classes in New York were night. So he had time off, and he went with me for 10 nights in a row. We went to a beginner's meeting and an open meeting. And after that, he knew what it was all about. He knew what I was doing. And I was at AA every night in the week except Saturday, because we had teenage children by then, and I wanted to be home to take care of whatever was going on. But I went every other night. And these wonderful changes began to take place in my life. Things that I just could not have believed. All the things that I had been looking for all those years in all those unlikely places, I began to find those things. And I found them in rooms like this with people like you, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And it was through this that I got the incentive from your example and the tool from your experience and the courage from your unfailing support to begin to face the realities of my own life a day at a time. And this whole new world appeared. And I couldn't believe what was happening to me. I still can't believe what happened to me. I don't know what I ever did to deserve being here. I don't know what I ever did to deserve all the things that AA has given me. Anything that could be given a person, AA has given to me. And I'm grateful beyond my ability to express it because I owe AA everything. Absolutely everything. And I have tried through the years to express my gratitude, at least partially, by love and service to this fellowship and to the people in it who have given me everything. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Whenever I speak, people who know me know, I always tell one story. Not because it's the worst thing that I ever did, but it didn't have the most far-reaching consequences either. But it sort of describes what my life was like and what I did with it as a result of alcoholic drinking. I went to a meeting in Manhattan, not in Manhattan, but in the New York area one night to speak at an anniversary. And the time was getting late. And they said in New York that no souls were saved after 10 o'clock, so sit down. If it got to be 10 o'clock, and so I quit, and I didn't tell his story. This man grabbed me by the throat after the meeting was over, and he said, you didn't tell the story about the dinner party, and that's the only reason I asked you. So I tell the story about the dinner party. Before I tell it, though, I had to share something with you. The first weekend in April, I was coming home from Suwannee. My youngest daughter was with me. We were going to the airport in Nashville, and she was going back to New York at 2 o'clock, and my plane didn't leave until 6. And an old colleague of my husband, who was teaching at his department at NYU at this time, was living in Nashville for a year or two, and he came out to the airport to spend this 4 hours with me. And he had been at that dinner party, and he said to me, "You remember how you and I had to get the lobster Newburgh up off the floor of the kitchen?" I said, "Yes, I do remember it." He said, "Corwise, I can hardly believe it." He said, "You really are a miracle. I don't know if you know it or not." I said, "I feel like I am." But anyway, a couple of years before I came into fellowship, Lee asked me if we would have, if I'd have a dinner party for the faculty and the staff of his department at NYU. And this man that I met in Nashville was, at that time, teaching one semester for Lee. My husband was chairman of the Department of Religion at New York University. He was also an Episcopal clergyman. Of course, I consented to have this party, and I worked hard to make it a success. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I had fixed the lobster Newburgh and whatever else we were having, and I was all ready for the party, and I was tired. Thought I'd take a little nap. And then I had one of those inspirations that occurs with some frequency to alcoholics. I thought, "I believe I'll have a little glass of sherry. This will help me to become drowsy." I knew a little glass of sherry did not make me drowsy. I knew it took a little bottle or so of sherry to get me drowsy. I also knew about the first drink. I knew it was the first drink that got me into trouble. I didn't know how you stay away from it. So I said, "Any fool will know enough to behave at a time like this." And so I applied reason. Any fool would know enough to behave at a time like this, and I took the first drink. I do not have to tell you the rest. By the time the company came, I was almost falling down drunk, close to hysterics as I always was when I drank, muttering what I hoped was incomprehensible gibberish. I say this because what I had to say was highly uncomplimentary to my husband, and it was not expressed in the language that most people associate with a clergyman's wife. Now, the people at this party, except for that one man, were strangers to me. They came from the Middle West. They came from different kind of background. They were teetotalers. Most of them didn't even smoke. They were the kind of people that I call squares. And I proceeded to call them that at the top of my lungs all evening. Now, you talk about arrogance. Here I was, the hostess, the professor's wife, the clergyman's wife, drunk and disorderly. You talk about arrogance. I was behaving in this way. They really behaved extremely well in what you will agree were fairly difficult circumstances. But I didn't give them credit for that. We're Episcopalians, and Episcopalians take a sort of liberal view toward social drinking. Not that they thought my drinking was social. I don't think they did. There's no telling what this crowd thought. My husband said he could have gotten away with anything in the world after that, because they all felt so sorry for him. Poor Lee. Whatever he did, they would have said, "But think what he has to put up with at home." And the fact that I didn't have a good reason to be lonely, with a fine husband and 2 wonderful children, and what could have been an interesting life. The fact that I had all these things and still felt as though I would die of loneliness only convinced me that I was a freak and undermined all my feelings of self-regard. But after this party, the loneliness became a really morbid thing. Because I decided I wouldn't do any drinking at all when other people were around. And I had been and am now a gregarious kind of person. But I no longer cared very much about being around people. I really didn't want to be around them. I didn't care what my husband sat and talked with me at night after the children went to bed. I told him, go on, play your typewriter. When I die, have somebody play the typewriter. That's all I ever hear. Don't have an organ or piano, just a typewriter. I didn't want to plan to do things with the children in the evenings, and sometimes not even on weekends. All I wanted was for them to get the hell out and leave me alone to drink in peace. Because there wasn't any peace. Because there isn't any peace in solitary confinement. And that's what booze had done to me. I was a lost soul in chains. Now, my chains may have been made out of crepe paper, but in my opinion, these are the very most difficult ones to break. I no longer feel like a lost soul, as I found a way where I have a choice. I can take one drink with all its consequences, or I can do it the AA way and stay away from one drink for one day. I no longer feel like a lost soul because my life began to take on some shape. I'd always thought I had to have goals in living. I found out I don't have to have goals. I have to have a way to go. And the way will take me to whatever I'm supposed to do, to the goal, if there is one. My way is the way of the 12 suggested steps and the 12 traditions in this program. And I fall down plenty of times, but I can get up again and move on and start all over again. There have been times when I would get discouraged and go through low spells, like I suppose we all do. And I remember one particular one many years ago when I was kicking the furniture and slamming the doors and banging the drawers and cursing under my breath to myself and saying, maybe you sold yourself a bill of goods. What's so different about your life anyway, except that you're sober? Except that I'm sober. That's the only thing in the world I was looking for. The only thing in the world I even hoped to find when I came here. And that was sobriety. And if I want to know what it would be like to lose it, I only have to remember those last 2 years when I drank alone, late at night, wandering up and down the stairs and the halls in my house, thinking going for one last drink. Always one last drink. Even then, I used to think, there must be some purpose in this. I must be looking for something that was missing from my life. And I was right about that one thing. I was looking for something. Thanks be to God, I found it. I was looking for AA. I was looking for all of you. Try to do things, other things beside AA. I belong to any number of discussion groups in churches and things of this kind. And I'm told how deep they are and how everybody you know is really sharing on a gut level. And I go there and I think, oh boy, maybe this is grand. I don't know. I'm used to AA. I'm used to us. I'm used to the way we do it. And you know, we deal with the deep stuff. We've been down there in the water, below the surface, down in the mud where the cottonmouths are. We deal with reality here, deep reality. And I don't know, maybe other people don't need to do this. We do. I do. You share with me so much, so deeply and so generously. This is what we do. We hold each other up these ways. I'm thought of as an old timer in my group, and I'm treated as though I were a relic. I say to him, you know, treat me like you do everybody else. Just because I'm old and have white hair and have been here a while, I need people to get off my case. But they just can't bring themselves to do it. I said, all you have to do to be an old timer is just live a long time and don't drink. You're an old timer. But they still treat me like a relic. So I'm glad to be here with some other old timers. They can tell me how it is. A couple of years ago, my nephew, I have two nephews who are in the program, and now I have a great nephew who's in it too. I was asked to speak at our group in Leland, and they all knew my story, and I said to Ralph, what should I talk about? He said, I want to talk about some of the things that have happened to you since you moved back here to live. Lots of you've had a lot of bad health and things have happened. Tell them about it. The message that I have to give about that, I can tell you about it and I will. But what I learned was that God is, when you have to have him, God is there. I learned that. That when I have to have it, he gives me what I have to have when I need it. I have had some bad health. The worst thing that's happened to me, of course, is that my husband died 7 years ago. Certainly this was not anything I desired or prayed for. But God didn't let me down. He gave me what I had to have when I had to have it. All my life I had been terrified to stay in the house overnight alone. I didn't mind it for the short period that we lived in apartments in New York because there were other people. But I was terrified of staying alone. And oh, when Lee would go away, I'd lock up and burn up with all the windows down, locked, and put chairs against the door, everything you ever heard of. When Lee went to the hospital for the last time, I wasn't afraid. I've never been afraid again. I was going to have to live this way. God made it possible. He gave me what I had to have when I had to have it. Had a lot of trouble with my eyes, a lot of respiratory trouble, and some trouble with my hip and my knee. There was a period when I was having great difficulty with the eyes, and there was a real question about whether I was going to save one eye or not. And I couldn't breathe. And I was driving home from the doctor's office, and I thought, what am I going to do? Who do I have to talk to? I have God, he's there. What I said to him was, please call off these dogs. And he did. He did. I drove home, I quit crying. I always have it. I really do. I'm not proud of the kinds of things that I've told you tonight. Not proud of all of them. Some of mine. I spent years trying to forget some of these things. I know now that I must not ever forget. Lest I forget to be grateful to God for helping me to find AA. Lest I forget to be grateful to AA for helping me to find my life. Thank you.
Got something
for you. Oh, bless you. On behalf of the board trustees, Louise. I should give you a present for having me here. Thank you.
Now, let's close the meeting in the usual way. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us.
I believe that's not into temptation.